Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Chapter 1 of The Poison Belt. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This recording is by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The Poison Belt by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Being an account of another adventure of Professor George E. Challenger, Lord John Roxton, Professor Summerlee, and Mr. E. D. Malone, the discoverers of the Lost World. Chapter 1, entitled The Blurring of Lines. It is imperative that now at once, while these stupendous events are still clear in my mind, I should set them down with that exactness of detail which time may blur. But even as I do so, I am overwhelmed by the wonder of the fact that it should be our little group of the Lost World, Professor Challenger, Professor Summerlee, Lord John Roxton, and myself, who have passed through this amazing experience. When, some years ago, I chronicled in the Daily Gazette our epoch-making journey in South America, I little thought that it should ever fall to my lot to tell an even stranger personal experience, one which is unique in all human annals and much stand out in the records of history as a great peak among the humble foothills which surround it. The event itself will always be marvelous, but the circumstances that we four were together at the time of this extraordinary episode came about in a most natural and, indeed, inevitable fashion. I will explain the events which led up to it as shortly and as clearly as I can, although I am well aware that the fuller the detail upon such a subject, the more welcome it will be to the reader, for the public curiosity has been and still is insatiable. It was upon Friday, the 27th of August, a date forever memorable in the history of the world, that I went down to the office of my paper and asked for 3 days' leave of absence from Mr. McArdle, who still presided over our news department. The good old Scotchman shook his head, scratched his dwindling fringe of ruddy fluff, and finally put his reluctance into words. "I was thinking, Mr. Malone, that we could employ you to advantage these days. I was thinking there was a story that you are the only man that could handle it as it should be handled." "I am sorry for that," said I, trying to hide my disappointment. "Of course, if I am needed, there is an end of the matter, but the engagement was important and intimate. If I could be spared, well, I don't see that you can." It was bitter, but I had to put the best face I could upon it. After all, it was my own fault, for I should have known by this time that a journalist has no right to make plans of his own. "Then I'll think no more of it," said I, with as much cheerfulness as I could assume at so short a notice. "What was it that you wanted me to do?" Well, it was just to interview that devil of a man down at Rotherfield. "You don't mean Professor Challenger," I cried. "Aye, it's just him that I do mean. He ran young Alec Simpson of the Courier a mile down the high road last week by the collar of his coat and the slack of his breeches. You'll have read of it, likely, in the police report. Our boys would as soon interview a loose alligator in the zoo. But you could do it, I'm thinking, an old friend like you." "Why," said I, greatly relieved, "that makes it all easy. It so happens that it was to visit Professor Challenger at Rotherfield that I was asking for leave of absence. The fact is that it is the anniversary of our main adventure on the plateau 3 years ago, and he has asked our whole party down to his house to see him and celebrate the occasion." "Capital!" cried Mr. McArdle, rubbing his hands and beaming through his glasses. "Then you will be able to get his opinions out of him. In any other man I would say it was all moonshine, but the fellow has made good once, and who knows but he may again." "Get what out of him?" I asked. "What has he been doing?" "Haven't you seen his letter on scientific possibilities in today's Times?" "No." McArdle dived down and picked a copy from the floor. "Read it aloud," said he, indicating a column with his finger. "I'd be glad to hear it again, for I am not sure now that I have the man's meaning clear in my head." This was the letter which I read to the news editor of the Gazette. "Scientific Possibilities. Sir, I have read with amusement, not wholly unmixed with some less complimentary emotion, the complacent and wholly fatuous letter of James Wilson MacPhail, which has lately appeared in your columns upon the subject of the blurring of Fraunhofer's lines in the spectra, both of the planets and of the fixed stars. He dismisses the matter as of no significance. To a wider intelligence it may well seem of very great possible importance, so great as to involve the ultimate welfare of every man, woman, and child upon this planet. I can hardly hope, by the use of scientific language, to convey any sense of my meaning to those ineffectual people who gather their ideas from the columns of a daily newspaper. I will endeavour, therefore, to condescend to their limitation, and to indicate the situation by the use of a homely analogy which will be within the limits of the intelligence of your readers." "Man, he's a wonder, a living wonder," said McArdle, shaking his head reflectively. "He'd put up the feathers of a sucking dove, and set up a riot at a Quakers' meeting. No wonder he has made London too hot for him. It's a pity, Mr. Malone, for it's a grand brain. Well, let's have the analogy." "We will suppose," I read, "that a small bundle of connected corks was launched in a sluggish current upon a voyage across the Atlantic. Corks drift slowly on from day to day with the same conditions all round them. If the corks were sentient, we could imagine that they would consider these conditions to be permanent and assured. But we, with our superior knowledge, know that many things might happen to surprise the corks. They may possibly float up against a ship, or a sleeping whale, or become entangled in seaweed. In any case, their voyage would probably end by their being thrown up on the rocky coast of Labrador. But what could they know of all this while they drifted so gently, day by day, in what they thought was a limitless and homogeneous ocean? Your readers will possibly comprehend that the Atlantic, in this parable, stands for the mighty ocean of ether through which we drift, and that the bunch of corks represents the little and obscure planetary system to which we belong. A third-rate sun, with its ragtag and bobtail of insignificant satellites, we float under the same daily conditions towards some unknown end, some squalid catastrophe which will overwhelm us at the ultimate confines of space, where we are swept over an etheric Niagara or dashed upon some unthinkable Labrador. I see no room here for the shallow and ignorant optimism of your correspondent, Mr. James Wilson MacPhail, but many reasons why we should watch with a very close and interested attention every indication of change in those cosmic surroundings upon which our own ultimate fate may depend.
"Man, he'd have made a grand minister," said McArdle. "It just booms like an organ. Let's get down to what it is that's troubling him."
"The general blurring and shifting of Fraunhofer's lines of the spectrum point, in my opinion, to a widespread cosmic change of a subtle and singular character. Light from a planet is the reflected light of the sun. Light from a star is a self-produced light. But the spectra both from planets and stars have, in this instance, all undergone the same change. Is it, then, a change in those planets and stars? To me, such an idea is inconceivable. What common change could simultaneously come upon them all? Is it a change in our own atmosphere? It is possible, but in the highest degree improbable, since we see no signs of it around us, and chemical analysis has failed to reveal it. What, then, is the third possibility? That it may be a change in the conducting medium, in that infinitely fine ether which extends from star to star and pervades the whole universe. Deep in that ocean we are floating upon a slow current. Might that current not drift out into belts of ether which are novel and have properties of which we have never conceived? There is a change somewhere. This cosmic disturbance of the spectrum proves it. It may be a good change. It may be an evil one. It may be a neutral one. We do not know. Shallow observers may treat the matter as one which can be disregarded, but one who, like myself, is possessed of the deeper intelligence of the true philosopher will understand that the possibilities of the universe are incalculable, and that the wisest man is he who holds himself ready for the unexpected. To take an obvious example, who would undertake to say that the mysterious and universal outbreak of illness recorded in your columns this very morning as having broken out among the indigenous races of Sumatra has no connection with some cosmic change to which they may respond more quickly than the more complex peoples of Europe? I throw out the idea for what it is worth. To assert it is, in the present stage, as unprofitable as to deny it, but it is an unimaginative numbskull who is too dense to perceive that is well within the bounds of scientific possibility. Yours faithfully, George Edward Challenger, The Briars, Rotherfield.
"It's a fine stimulating letter," said McArdle thoughtfully, fitting a cigarette into the long glass tube which he used as a holder. "What's your opinion of it, Mr. Malone?"
I had to confess my total and humiliating ignorance of the subject at issue. What, for example, were Fraunhofer's lines? McArdle had just been studying the matter with the aid of our tame scientist at the office, and he picked from his desk two of those many-colored spectral bands which bear a general resemblance to the hat ribbons of some young and ambitious cricket club. He pointed out to me that there were certain black lines which formed crossbars upon the series of brilliant colors, extending from the red at one end, through gradations of orange, yellow, green, blue, and indigo, to the violet at the other.
"Those dark bands are Fraunhofer's lines," said he. "The colors are just light itself. Every light, if you can split it up with a prism, gives the same colors. They tell us nothing. It is the lines that count, because they vary according to what it may be that produces the light. It is these lines that have been blurred instead of clear this last week, and all the astronomers have been quarrelling over the reason. Here's a photograph of the blurred lines for our issue tomorrow. The public have taken no interest in the matter up to now, but this letter of Challenger's in the Times will make them wake up, I'm thinking."
"And this about Sumatra?"
"Well, it's a long cry from a blurred line in a spectrum to a sick nigger in Sumatra, and yet the Chiel has shown us once before that he knows what he's talking about. There is some queer illness down yonder, that's beyond all doubt, and today there's a cable just come in from Singapore that the lighthouses are out of action in the Straits of Sundan, and two ships on the beach in consequence. Anyhow, it's good enough for you to interview Challenger upon. If you get anything definite, let us have a column by Monday." I was coming out from the news editor's room, turning over my new mission in my mind, when I heard my name called from the waiting room below. It was a telegraph boy with a wire which had been forwarded from my lodgings at Streatham. The message was from the very man we had been discussing, and ran thus: "Malone, 17, Hill Street, Streatham. Bring oxygen. Challenger." Bring oxygen! The professor, as I remembered him, had an elephantine sense of humor capable of the most clumsy and unwieldy gambolings. Was this one of those jokes which used to reduce him to uproarious laughter, when his eyes would disappear and he was all gaping mouth and wagging beard, supremely indifferent to the gravity of all around him? I turned the words over, but could make nothing even remotely jocose out of them. Then surely it was a concise order, though a very strange one. He was the last man in the world whose deliberate command I should care to disobey. Possibly some chemical experiment was afoot. Possibly, well, it was no business of mine to speculate upon why he wanted it. I must get it. There was nearly an hour before I should catch the train at Victoria. I took a taxi, and having ascertained the address from the telephone book, I made for the Oxygen Tube Supply Company in Oxford Street. As I alighted on the pavement at my destination, two youths emerged from the door of the establishment carrying an iron cylinder, which, with some trouble, they hoisted into a waiting motor-car. An elderly man was at their heels, scolding and directing in a creaky, sardonic voice. He turned towards me. There was no mistaking those austere features and that goatee beard. It was my old cross-grained companion, Professor Summerlee. "What!" he cried. "Don't tell me that you have had one of those preposterous telegrams for oxygen." I exhibited it. "Well, well, I have had one too, and as you see, very much against the grain, I have acted upon it. Our good friend is as impossible as ever." "The need for oxygen could not have been so urgent that he must desert the usual means of supply and encroach upon the time of those who are really busier than himself. Why could he not order it direct?" I could only suggest that he probably wanted it at once. "Or thought he did, which is quite another matter. But it is superfluous now for you to purchase any, since I have this considerable supply." Still, for some reason, he seems to wish that I should bring oxygen too. It will be safer to do exactly what he tells me. Accordingly, in spite of many grumbles and remonstrances from Summerlee, I ordered an additional tube, which was placed with the other in his motor-car, for he had offered me a lift to Victoria. I turned away to pay off my taxi, the driver of which was very cantankerous and abusive over his fare. As I came back to Professor Summerlee, he was having a furious altercation with the men who had carried down the oxygen, his little white goat's beard jerking with indignation. One of the fellows called him, I remember, a silly old bleached cockatoo, which so enraged his chauffeur that he bounded out of his seat to take the part of his insulted master, and it was all we could do to prevent a riot in the street. These little things may seem trivial to relate, and passed as mere incidents at the time. It is only now, as I look back, that I see their relation to the whole story which I have to unfold. The chauffeur must, as it seemed to me, have been a novice, or else have lost his nerve in this disturbance, for he drove vilely on the way to the station. Twice we nearly had collisions with other equally erratic vehicles, and I remember remarking to Summerlee that the standard of driving in London had very much declined. Once we brushed the very edge of a great crowd which was watching a fight at the corner of the Mall. The people, who were much excited, raised cries of anger at the clumsy driving, and one fellow sprang upon the step and waved a stick above our heads.
I pushed him off, but we were glad when we had got clear of them and safe out of the park. These little events, coming one after the other, left me very jangled in my nerves, and I could see from my companion's petulant manner that his own patience had got to a low ebb. But our good humour was restored when we saw Lord John Roxton waiting for us upon the platform, his tall, thin figure clad in a yellow tweed shooting suit. His keen face, with those unforgettable eyes, so fierce and yet so humorous, flashed with pleasure at the sight of us. His ruddy hair was shot with grey, and the furrows upon his brow had been cut a little deeper by time's chisel, but in all else he was the Lord John who had been our good comrade in the past.
"Hello, Herr Professor! Hello, young fella!" he shouted as he came toward us. He roared with amusement when he saw the oxygen cylinders upon the porter's trolley behind us. "So you've got them, too!" he cried. "Mine is in the van. Whatever can the old dear be after?"
"Have you seen his letter in the Times?" I asked.
"What was it?" "Stuff and nonsense," said Summerlee harshly.
"Well, it's at the bottom of this oxygen business, or I am mistaken," said I.
"Stuff and nonsense," cried Summerlee again with quite unnecessary violence.
We'd all got into a first-class smoker, and he'd already lit the short and charred old briar pipe which seemed to singe the end of his long, aggressive nose.
"Friend Challenger is a clever man," said he with great vehemence. "No one can deny it. It's a fool that denies it. Look at his hat. There's a 60-ounce brain inside it, a big engine, running smooth, and turning out clean work. Show me the engine house and I'll tell you the size of the engine. But he is a born charlatan. You've heard me tell him so to his face. A born charlatan, with a kind of dramatic trick of jumping into the limelight. Things are quiet, so friend Challenger sees a chance to set the public talking about him. You don't imagine that he seriously believes all this nonsense about a change in the ether and a danger to the human race? Was ever such a cock-and-bull story in this life?" He sat like an old white raven, croaking and shaking with sardonic laughter. A wave of anger passed through me as I listened to Summerlee. It was disgraceful that he should speak thus of the leader who had been the source of all our fame and given us such an experience as no men have ever enjoyed. I had opened my mouth to utter some hot retort when Lord John got before me. "You had a scrap once before with old man Challenger," said he sternly, "and you were down and out inside 10 seconds. It seems to me, Professor Summerlee, that he's beyond your class, and the best you can do with him is to walk wide and leave him alone."
"Besides," said I, "he has been a good friend to every one of us. Whatever his faults may be, he is as straight as a line, and I don't believe he ever speaks evil of his comrades behind their backs."
"Well said, young fellow, my lad," said Lord John Roxton.
Then, with a kindly smile, he slapped Professor Summerlee upon his shoulder.
"Come, Herr Professor, we're not going to quarrel at this time of day. We've seen too much together. But keep off the grass when you get near Challenger, for this young fellow and I have a bit of a weakness for the old dear."
But Summerlee was in no humour for compromise. His face was screwed up in rigid disapproval, and thick curls of angry smoke rolled up from his pipe.
"As to you, Lord John Roxton," he creaked, "your opinion upon a matter of science is of as much value in my eyes as my views upon a new type of shotgun would be in yours. I have my own judgment, sir, and I use it in my own way. Because it has misled me once, is that any reason why I should accept without criticism anything, however far-fetched, which this man may care to put forward? Are we to have a pope of science, with infallible decrees laid down ex cathedra, and accepted without question by the poor, humble public? I tell you, sir, that I have a brain of my own. and that I should feel myself to be a snob and a slave if I did not use it. If it pleases you to believe this rigmarole about ether and Fraunhofer's lines upon the spectrum, do so by all means, but do not ask one who is older and wiser than yourself to share in your folly. Is it not evident that if the ether were affected to the degree which he maintains, and if it were obnoxious to human health, the result of it would already be apparent upon ourselves? Here he laughed with uproarious triumph over his own argument. Ha, ha, ha! Yes, sir! We should already be very far from our normal selves, and instead of sitting quietly discussing scientific problems in a railway train, we should be showing actual symptoms of the poison which was working within us. Where do we see any signs of this poisonous cosmic disturbance? Answer me that, sir. Answer me that. Come, come, no evasions. I pin you to an answer. I felt more and more angry. There was something very irritating and aggressive in Summerlee's demeanor. I think that if you knew more about the facts, you might be less positive in your opinion, said I. Summerlee took his pipe from his mouth and fixed me with a stony stare. Pray, what do you mean, sir, by that somewhat impertinent observation? I mean that when I was leaving the office, the news editor told me that a telegram had come in confirming the general illness of the Sumatra natives, and adding that the lights had not been lit in the Straits of Sunda.
Really? There should be some limits to human folly, cried Summerlee in a positive fury. Is it possible that you do not realize that ether, if for a moment we adopt Challenger's preposterous supposition, is a universal substance which is the same here as at the other side of the world? Do you for an instant suppose that there is an English ether and a Sumatran ether? Perhaps you imagine that the ether of Kent is in some way superior to the ether of Surrey, through which this train is now bearing us. There really are no bounds to the credulity and ignorance of the average layman. Is it conceivable that the ether in Sumatra should be so deadly as to cause total insensibility at the very time when the ether here has had no appreciable effect upon us whatever? Personally, I can truly say that I never felt stronger in body or better balanced in mind in my life.
That may be. I don't profess to be a scientific man, said I, though I have heard somewhere that the science of one generation is usually the fallacy of the next. But it does not take much common sense to see that, as we seem to know so little about ether, it might be affected by some local conditions in various parts of the world, and might show an effect over there which would only develop later with us.
With might and may you can prove anything, cried Summerlee furiously. Pigs may fly. Yes, sir, pigs may fly, but they don't. It is not worth arguing with you. Challenger has filled you with his nonsense, and you are both incapable of reason. I had as soon lay arguments before those railway cushions.
I must say, Professor Summerlee, that your manners do not seem to have improved since I last had the pleasure of meeting you, said Lord John severely.
You lordlings are not accustomed to hear the truth, Summerlee answered with a bitter smile. It comes as a bit of a shock, does it not, when someone makes you realize that your title leaves you none of the less a very ignorant man?
Upon my word, sir, said Lord John, very stern and rigid, if you were a younger man, you would not dare to speak to me in so offensive a fashion. Summerlee thrust out his chin, with its little wagging tuft of goatee beard.
I would have you know, sir, that young or old, there has never been a time in my life when I was afraid to speak my mind to an ignorant coxcomb. Yes, sir, an ignorant coxcomb, if you had as many titles as slaves could invent and fools could adopt.
For a moment Lord John's eyes blazed, and then with a tremendous effort he mastered his anger and leaned back in his seat
with arms folded and a bitter smile upon his face. To me all this was dreadful and deplorable. Like a wave, the memory of the past swept over me, the good comradeship, the happy, adventurous days, all that we had suffered and worked for and won. That it should have come to this, to insults and abuse. Suddenly I was sobbing, sobbing in loud, gulping, uncontrollable sobs which refused to be concealed. My companions looked at me in surprise. I covered my face with my hands. "It's all right," said I. Only it is such a pity." "You're ill, young fella, that's what's amiss with you," said Lord John. "I thought you were queer from the first."
"Your habits, sir, have not mended in these 3 years," said Summerlee, shaking his head. "I also did not fail to observe your strange manner the moment we met. You need not waste your sympathy, Lord John. These tears are purely alcoholic. The man has been drinking. By the way, Lord John, I called you a coxcomb just now, which was perhaps unduly severe.
But the word reminds me of a small accomplishment, trivial but amusing, which I used to possess. You know me as the austere man of science. Can you believe that I once had a well-deserved reputation in several nurseries as a farmyard imitator? Perhaps I can help you to pass the time in a pleasant way. Would it amuse you to hear me crow like a cock?"
"No, sir," said Lord John, who was still greatly offended, "it would not amuse me." "My imitation of the clucking hen who has just laid an egg was also considered rather above the average. Might I venture?"
"No, sir, no, certainly not."
But in spite of this earnest prohibition, Professor Summerlee laid down his pipe, and for the rest of our journey he entertained, or failed to entertain, us by a succession of bird and animal cries which seemed so absurd that my tears were suddenly changed into boisterous laughter, which must have become quite hysterical as I sat opposite this grave professor and saw him, or rather heard him, in the character of the uproarious rooster or the puppy whose tail had been trodden upon. Once Lord John passed across his newspaper, upon the margin of which he had written in pencil, "Poor devil, mad as a hatter." No doubt it was very eccentric, and yet the performance struck me as extraordinarily clever and amusing. Whilst this was going on, Lord John leaned forward and told me some interminable story about a buffalo and an Indian rajah, which seemed to me to have neither beginning nor end. Professor Summerlee had just begun to chirrup like a canary, and Lord John to get to the climax of his story, when the train drew up at Jarvis Brook, which had been given us as the station for Rotherfield. And there was Challenger to meet us. His appearance was glorious. Not all the turkey cocks in creation could match the slow, high-stepping dignity with which he paraded his own railway station, and the benignant smile of condescending encouragement with which he regarded everybody around him. If he had changed in anything since the days of old, it was that his points had become accentuated. The huge head and broad sweep of forehead, with its plastered lock of black hair, seemed even greater than before. His black beard poured forward in a more impressive cascade, and his clear grey eyes, with their insolent and sardonic eyelids, were even more masterful than of yore. He gave me the amused handshake and encouraging smile which the headmaster bestows upon the small boy, and having greeted the others and helped to collect their bags and their cylinders of oxygen, he stowed us and them away in a large motor car, which was driven by the same impassive Austin, the man of few words, which I had seen in the character of butler upon the occasion of my first eventful visit to the professor. Our journey led us up a winding hill through beautiful country. I sat in front with the chauffeur, but behind me my three comrades seemed to me to be all talking together. Lord John was still struggling with his buffalo story, so far as I could make out, while once again I heard, as of old, the deep rumble of Challenger and the insistent accents of Summerlee as their brains locked in high and fierce scientific debate. Suddenly Austin slanted his mahogany face toward me without taking his eyes from his steering wheel.
"I'm under notice," said he.
"Dear me," said I. "Everything seems strange today. Everyone said queer, unexpected things. It was like a dream."
"It's 47 times," said Austin reflectively.
"When do you go?" I asked, for want of some better observation.
"I don't go," said Austin.
The conversation seemed to have ended there, but presently he came back to it.
"If I was to go, who would look after him?"
He jerked his head toward his master.
"Who would he get to serve him?"
"Someone else," I suggested lamely. "Not he. No one would stay a week. If I was to go, that house would run down like a watch with the mainspring out. I'm telling you because you're his friend, and you ought to know. If I was to take him at his word, but there, I wouldn't have the art. He and the missus would be like two babes left out in a bundle. I'm just everything. And then he goes and gives me notice."
"Why would no one stay?" I asked.
"Well, they wouldn't make allowances, same as I do. He's a very clever man, the master. So clever that he's clean balmy sometimes. I've seen him right off his onion, and no error. Well, look what he did this morning."
"What did he do?"
Austin bent over to me.
"He bit the housekeeper,"
said he in a hoarse whisper.
"Bit her?"
"Yes, sir. Bit her on the leg. I saw her with my own eyes starting a marathon from the hall door."
"Good gracious!"
"So you'd say, sir, if you could see some of the goings on. He don't make friends with the neighbors. There's some of them thinks that when he was up among them monsters you wrote about, it was just home sweet home for the master, and he was never in fitter company. That's what they say. But I've served him 10 years, and I'm fond of him. And mind you, he's a great man, when all's said and done, and it's an honor to serve him. But he does try one cruel at times. Now look at that, sir. That ain't what you might call old-fashioned hospitality, is it now? Just you read it for yourself."
The car on its lowest speed had ground its way up a steep, curving ascent. At the corner a notice-board peered over a well-clipped hedge. As Austin said, it was not difficult to read, for the words were few and arresting.
"Warning. Visitors, pressmen, and mendicants are not encouraged. G.E. Challenger."
"No, it's not what you might call hearty," said Austin, shaking his head and glancing up at the deplorable placard. "It wouldn't look well in a Christmas card. I beg your pardon, sir, for I haven't spoke as much as this for many a long year, but today my feelings seem to have got the better of me. He can sack me till he's blue in the face, but I ain't going, that's flat. I'm his man and he's my master, and so it will be, I expect, to the end of the chapter."
We had passed between the white posts of a gate and up a curving drive lined with rhododendron bushes. Beyond stood a low brick house, picked out with white woodwork, very comfortable and pretty. Mrs. Challenger, a small, dainty, smiling figure, stood in the open doorway to welcome us.
"Well, my dear," said Challenger, bustling out of the car, "here are our visitors. It is something new for us to have visitors, is it not? No love lost between us and our neighbors, is there? If they could get rat poison into our baker's cart, I expect it would be there."
"It's dreadful, dreadful," said the lady between laughter and tears. "George is always quarrelling with everyone. We haven't a friend on the countryside."
"It enables me to concentrate my attention upon my incomparable wife," said Challenger, passing his short thick arm around her waist. Picture a gorilla and a gazelle, and you have the pair of them. "Come, come, these gentlemen are tired from the journey, and luncheon should be ready. Has Sarah returned?"
The lady shook her head ruefully,
and the professor laughed loudly and stroked his beard in his masterful fashion.
"Austin," he cried, "when you have put up the car, you will kindly help your mistress to lay the lunch. Now, gentlemen, would you please step into my study, for there are one or two very urgent things which I am anxious to say to you."
End of chapter.
Chapter 2 of The Poison Belt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Poison Belt by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 2, entitled The Tide of Death. As we crossed the hall, the telephone bell rang, and we were the involuntary auditors of Professor Challenger's end of the ensuing dialogue. I say we, but no one within 100 yards could have failed to hear the booming of that monstrous voice which reverberated through the house. His answers lingered in my mind.
"Yes, yes, of course, it is I. Yes, certainly, the Professor Challenger, the famous professor, who else? Of course, every word of it, otherwise I should not have written it. I shouldn't be surprised. There is every indication of it. Within a day or so at the furthest. Well, I can't help that, can I? Very unpleasant, no doubt, but I rather fancy it will affect more important people than you. There is no use whining about it. No, I couldn't possibly. You must take your chance. That's enough, sir. Nonsense. I have something more important to do than to listen to such twaddle."
He shut off with a crash and led us upstairs into a large airy apartment which formed his study. On the great mahogany desk, 7 or 8 unopened telegrams were lying.
"Really," he said as he gathered them up, "I begin to think that it would save my correspondent's money if I were to adopt a telegraphic address. Possibly Noah Rotherfield would be the most appropriate."
As usual, when he made an obscure joke, he leaned against the desk and bellowed in a paroxysm of laughter, his hands shaking so that he could hardly open the envelopes.
"Noah! Noah!"
he gasped with a face of beetroot, while Lord John and I smiled in sympathy, and Summerlee, like a dyspeptic goat, wagged his head in sardonic disagreement. Finally, Challenger, still rumbling and exploding, began to open his telegrams. The three of us stood in the bow window and occupied ourselves in admiring the magnificent view. It was certainly worth looking at. The road in its gentle curves had really brought us to a considerable elevation, 700 feet, as we afterwards discovered. Challenger's house was on the very edge of the hill, and from its southern face, in which was the study window, one looked across the vast stretch of the Weald to where the gentle curves of the South Downs formed an undulating horizon. In a cleft of the hills, a haze of smoke marked the position of Lewes. Immediately at our feet there lay a rolling plain of heather, with the long, vivid green stretches of the Crowborough golf course, all dotted with the players. A little to the south, through an opening in the woods, we could see a section of the main line from London to Brighton. In the immediate foreground, under our very noses, was a small enclosed yard, in which stood the car which had brought us from the station. An ejaculation from Challenger caused us to turn. He had read his telegrams and had arranged them in a little methodical pile upon his desk. His broad, rugged face, or as much of it as was visible over the matted beard, was still deeply flushed, and he seemed to be under the influence of some strong excitement.
"Well, gentlemen," he said, in a voice as if he were addressing a public meeting, "this is indeed an interesting reunion, and it takes place under extraordinary, I may say unprecedented, circumstances. May I ask if you observed anything upon your journey from town?"
"The only thing which I observed," said Summerlee with a sour smile,
was that our young friend here has not improved in his manners during the years that have passed. I am sorry to state that I have had to seriously complain of his conduct in the train, and I should be wanting in frankness if I did not say that it has left a most unpleasant impression in my mind.
"Well, well, we all get a bit prosy sometimes," said Lord John. "The young fellow meant no real harm. After all, he's an international, so if he takes a half an hour to describe a game of football, he has more right to do it than most folk."
"Half an hour to describe a game?" I cried indignantly. "Why, it was you that took half an hour with some long-winded story about a buffalo. Professor Summerlee will be my witness."
"I can hardly judge which of you was the most utterly wearisome," said Summerlee. "I declare to you, Challenger, that I never wish to hear of football or of buffaloes so long as I live."
"I have never said one word today about football," I protested.
Lord John gave a shrill whistle, and Summerlee shook his head sadly.
"So early in the day, too," said he. "It is indeed deplorable. As I sat there in sad but thoughtful silence..."
"In silence?" cried Lord John. "Why, you were doing a music-hall turn of imitations all the way. More like a runaway gramophone than a man."
Summerlee drew himself up in bitter protest. "You are pleased to be facetious, Lord John," said he with a face of vinegar.
"Why, dash it all, this is clear madness," cried Lord John. "Each of us seems to know what the others did, and none of us knows what he did himself. Let's put it all together from the first. We got into a first-class smoker, that's clear, ain't it? Then we began to quarrel over friend Challenger's letter in the Times."
"Oh, you did you?" rumbled our host, his eyelids beginning to droop.
"You said, Summerlee, that there was no possible truth in his contention."
"Dear me,"
said Challenger, puffing out his chest and stroking his beard, "no possible truth. I seem to have heard the words before. And may I ask with what arguments the great and famous Professor Summerlee proceeded to demolish the humble individual who had ventured to express an opinion upon a matter of scientific possibility? Perhaps before he exterminates that unfortunate non-entity, he will condescend to give some reasons for the adverse views which he has formed."
He bowed and shrugged and spread open his hands as he spoke with his elaborate and elephantine sarcasm.
"The reason was simple enough," said the dogged Summerlee. "I contended that if the ether surrounding the earth was so toxic in one quarter that it produced dangerous symptoms, it was hardly likely that we three in the railway carriage should be entirely unaffected."
The explanation only brought uproarious merriment from Challenger. He laughed until everything in the room seemed to rattle and quiver.
"Our worthy Summerlee is, not for the first time, somewhat out of touch with the facts of the situation," said he at last, mopping his heated brow. "Now, gentlemen, I cannot make my point better than by detailing to you what I have myself done this morning. You will the more easily condone any mental aberration upon your own part when you realize that even I have had moments when my balance has been disturbed. We have had for some years in this household a housekeeper, one Sarah, with whose second name I have never attempted to burden my memory. She is a woman of a severe and forbidding aspect, prim and demure in her bearing, very impassive in her nature, and never known within our experience to show signs of any emotion. As I sat alone at my breakfast, Mrs. Challenger is in the habit of keeping her room of a morning, it suddenly entered my head that it would be entertaining and instructive to see whether I could find any limits to this woman's imperturbability. I devised a simple but effective experiment. Having upset a small vase of flowers which stood in the center of the cloth, I rang the bell and slipped under the table. She entered, and seeing the room empty, imagined that I had withdrawn to the study. As I had expected,
She approached and leaned over the table to replace the vase. I had a vision of a cotton stocking and an elastic-sided boot. Protruding my head, I sank my teeth into the calf of her leg. The experiment was successful beyond belief. For some moments she stood paralyzed, staring down at my head. Then, with a shriek, she tore herself free and rushed from the room. I pursued her with some thoughts of an explanation, but she flew down the drive, and some minutes afterwards I was able to pick her out with my field glasses, travelling very rapidly in a southwesterly direction. I tell you the anecdote for what it is worth. I drop it into your brains and await its germination. Is it illuminative? Has it conveyed anything to your minds? What do you think of it, Lord John?"
Lord John shook his head gravely.
"You'll be getting into serious trouble some of these days if you don't put a brake on," said he. "Perhaps you have some observation to make, Summerlee."
"You should drop all work instantly, Challenger, and take 3 months in a German watering-place," said he.
"Profound, profound!" cried Challenger. "Now, my young friend, is it possible that wisdom may come from you where your seniors have so signally failed?"
And it did. I say it with all modesty, but it did. Of course, it all seems obvious enough to you who know what occurred, but it was not so very clear when everything was new. But it came upon me suddenly with the full force of absolute conviction.
"Poison!"
I cried. Then, even as I said the word, my mind flashed back over the whole morning's experiences, past Lord John with his buffalo, past my own hysterical tears, past the outrageous conduct of Professor Summerlee, to the queer happenings in London, the row in the park, the driving of the chauffeur, the quarrel at the oxygen warehouse. Everything fitted suddenly into its place.
"Of course," I cried again, "it is poison. We are all poisoned."
"Exactly," said Challenger, rubbing his hands. "We are all poisoned. Our planet has swum into the poison belt of ether, and is now flying deeper into it at the rate of some millions of miles a minute. Our young friend has expressed the cause of all our troubles and perplexities in a single word, poison."
We looked at each other in amazed silence. No comment seemed to meet the situation.
"There is a mental inhibition by which such symptoms can be checked and controlled," said Challenger. "I cannot expect to find it developed in all of you to the same point which it has reached in me, for I suppose that the strength of our different mental processes bears some proportion to each other. But no doubt it is appreciable even in our young friend here. After the little outburst of high spirits which so alarmed my domestic, I sat down and reasoned with myself. I put it to myself that I had never before felt impelled to bite any of my household. The impulse had then been an abnormal one. In an instant I perceived the truth. My pulse upon examination was 10 beats above the usual, and my reflexes were increased. I called upon my higher and saner self, the real GEC, seated serene and impregnable behind all mere molecular disturbance. I summoned him, I say, to watch the foolish mental tricks which the poison would play. I found that I was indeed the master. I could recognize and control a disordered mind. It was a remarkable exhibition of the victory of mind over matter, for it was a victory over that particular form of matter which is most intimately connected with mind. I might almost say that mind was at fault, and that personality controlled it. Thus, when my wife came downstairs and I was impelled to slip behind the door and alarm her by some wild cry as she entered, I was able to stifle the impulse and to greet her with dignity and restraint. An overpowering desire to quack like a duck was met and mastered in the same fashion. Later, when I descended to order the car and found Austin bending over it absorbed in repairs, I controlled my open hand even after I had lifted it, and refrained from giving him an experience which would possibly have caused him to follow in the steps of the housekeeper. On the contrary,
I touched him on the shoulder and ordered the car to be at the door in time to meet your train. At the present instant I am most forcibly tempted to take Professor Summerlee by that silly old beard of his and to shake his head violently backwards and forwards. And yet, as you see, I am perfectly restrained. Let me commend my example to you. I'll look out for that buffalo, said Lord John. And I for the football match.
It may be that you are right, Challenger, said Summerlee in a chastened voice. I am willing to admit that my turn of mind is critical rather than constructive, and that I am not a ready convert to any new theory, especially when it happens to be so unusual and fantastic as this one. However, as I cast my mind back over the events of the morning, and as I reconsider the fatuous conduct of my companions, I find it easy to believe that some poison of an exciting kind was responsible for their symptoms.
Challenger slapped his colleague good-humouredly upon the shoulder. "We progress," said he. "Decidedly, we progress."
"And pray, sir," asked Summerlee humbly, "what is your opinion as to the present outlook?"
"With your permission, I will say a few words upon that subject."
He seated himself upon his desk, his short, stumpy legs swinging in front of him.
"We are assisting at a tremendous and awful function. It is, in my opinion, the end of the world."
The end of the world! Our eyes turned to the great bow window, and we looked out at the summer beauty of the countryside, the long slopes of heather, the great country houses, the cozy farms, the pleasure-seekers upon the links.
The end of the world!
One had often heard the words, but the idea that they could ever have an immediate practical significance, that it should not be at some vague date, but now, today, that was a tremendous, a staggering thought. We were all struck solemn and waited in silence for Challenger to continue. His overpowering presence and appearance lent such force to the solemnity of his words that for a moment all the crudities and absurdities of the man vanished, and he loomed before us as something majestic and beyond the range of ordinary humanity. Then, to me at least, there came back the cheering recollection of how twice since we had entered the room he had roared with laughter. Surely, I thought, there are limits to mental detachment. The crisis cannot be so great or so pressing after all.
"You will conceive a bunch of grapes," said he, "which are covered by some infinitesimal but noxious bacillus. The gardener passes it through a disinfecting medium. It may be that he desires his grapes to be cleaner. It may be that he needs space to breed some fresh bacillus less noxious than the last. He dips it into the poison and they are gone. Our gardener is, in my opinion, about to dip the solar system and the human bacillus, the little mortal vibrio which twisted and wriggled upon the outer rind of the earth, will in an instant be sterilized out of existence."
Again there was silence. It was broken by the high trill of the telephone bell.
"There is one of our bacilli squeaking for help," said he with a grim smile. "They are beginning to realize that their continued existence is not really one of the necessities of the universe."
He was gone from the room for a minute or two. I remember that none of us spoke in his absence. The situation seemed beyond all words or comments.
"The medical officer of health for Brighton," said he when he returned, "the symptoms are for some reason developing more rapidly upon the sea level. Our 700 feet of elevation give us an advantage. Folks seem to have learned that I am the first authority upon the question. No doubt it comes from my letter in the Times. That was the mayor of a provincial town with whom I talked when we first arrived. You may have heard me upon the telephone. He seemed to put an entirely inflated value upon his own life. I helped him to readjust his ideas."
Summerlee had risen and was standing by the window. His thin, bony hands were trembling with his emotion.
"Challenger," said he earnestly, "This thing is too serious for mere futile argument. Do not suppose that I desire to irritate you by any question I may ask, but I put it to you whether there may not be some fallacy in your information or in your reasoning. There is the sun shining as brightly as ever in the blue sky. There are the heather and the flowers and the birds. There are the folk enjoying themselves upon the golf links, and the labourers yonder cutting the corn. You tell us that they and we may be on the very brink of destruction, that this sunlit day may be that day of doom which the human race has so long awaited. So far as we know, you found this tremendous judgment upon what? Upon some abnormal lines in a spectrum, upon rumours from Sumatra, upon some curious personal excitement which we have discerned in each other. This latter symptom is not so marked but that you and we could, by a deliberate effort, control it. You need not stand on ceremony with us, Challenger. We have all faced death together before now. Speak out, and let us know exactly where we stand, and what, in your opinion, are our prospects for our future." It was a brave, good speech. A speech from that staunch and strong spirit which lay behind all the acidities and angularities of the old zoologist. Lord John rose and shook him by the hand. "My sentiment to a tick," said he. "Now, Challenger, it's up to you to tell us where we are. We ain't nervous folk, as you know well, but when it comes to making a weekend visit and finding you've run full butt into the Day of Judgment, it wants a bit of explaining. What's the danger, and how much of it is there, and what are we going to do to meet it?" He stood, tall and strong, in the sunshine at the window, with his brown hand upon the shoulder of Summerlee. I was lying back in an armchair, an extinguished cigarette between my lips, in that sort of half-dazed state in which impressions become exceedingly distinct. It may have been a new phase of the poisoning, but the delirious promptings had all passed away, and were succeeded by an exceedingly languid and, at the same time, perceptive state of mind. I was a spectator. It did not seem to be any personal concern of mine, but here were three strong men at a great crisis, and it was fascinating to observe them. Challenger bent his heavy brows and stroked his beard before he answered. One could see that he was very carefully weighing his words.
"What was the last news when you left London?" he asked.
"I was at the Gazette office about 10, said I. "There was a writer just come in from Singapore to the effect that the sickness seemed to be universal in Sumatra, and that the lighthouses had not been lit in consequence."
"Events have been moving somewhat rapidly since then," said Challenger, picking up his pile of telegrams. "I am in close touch both with the authorities and with the press, so that news is converging upon me from all parts. There is, in fact, a general and very insistent demand that I should come to London. But I see no good end to be served. From the accounts, the poisonous effect begins with mental excitement. The rioting in Paris this morning is said to have been very violent, and the Welsh colliers are in a state of uproar. So far as the evidence to hand can be trusted, this stimulative stage, which varies much in races and in individuals, is succeeded by a certain exaltation and mental lucidity. I seem to discern some signs of it at our young friend here, which, after an appreciable interval, turns to coma, deepening rapidly into death. I fancy, so far as my toxicology carries me, that there are some vegetable nerve poisons."
"Datura," suggested Summerlee.
"Excellent," cried Challenger. "It would make for scientific precision if we named our toxic agent. Let it be daturon. To you, my dear Summerlee, belongs the honour, posthumous, alas, but none the less unique, of having given a name to the universal destroyer, the great gardener's disinfectant. The symptoms of daturon, then, may be taken to be such as I indicate, that it will involve the whole world and that no life can possibly remain behind seems to me to be certain. since ether is a universal medium. Up to now it has been capricious in the places where it is attacked, but the difference is only a matter of a few hours, and it is like an advancing tide which covers one strip of sand and then another, running hither and thither in irregular streams, until at last it has submerged it all. There are laws at work in connection with the action and distribution of Daturon, which would have been of deep interest had the time at our disposal permitted us to study them. So far as I can trace them, here he glanced over his telegrams, the less developed races have been the first to respond to its influence. There are deplorable accounts from Africa, and the Australian Aborigines appear to have been already exterminated. The northern races have as yet shown greater resisting power than the southern. This, you see, is dated from Marseilles at 9:45 this morning. I give it to you verbatim. All night, delirious excitement throughout Provence. Tumult of vine growers at Nîmes. Socialistic upheaval at Toulon. Sudden illness attended by coma attacked population this morning. Peste foudroyante. Great numbers of dead in the streets, paralysis of business, and universal chaos. An hour later came the following, from the same source. We are threatened with utter extermination, cathedrals and churches full to overflowing. The dead outnumber the living. It is inconceivable and horrible. Decease seems to be painless, but swift and inevitable. There is a similar telegram from Paris, where the development is not yet as acute. India and Persia appear to be utterly wiped out. The Slavonic population of Austria is down, while the Teutonic has hardly been affected. Speaking generally, the dwellers upon the plains and upon the seashore seem, so far as my limited information goes, to have felt the effects more rapidly than those inland or on the heights. Even a little elevation makes a considerable difference, and perhaps if there be a survivor of the human race, he will again be found upon the summit of some Ararat. Even our own little hill may presently prove to be a temporary island amid a sea of disaster. But at the present rate of advance, a few short hours will submerge us all. Lord John Roxton wiped his brow.
"What beats me," said he, "is how you could sit there laughing with that stack of telegrams under your hand. I've seen death as often as most folk, but universal death, it's awful."
"As to the laughter," said Challenger, "you will bear in mind that, like yourselves, I have not been exempt from the stimulating cerebral effects of the etheric poison. But as to the horror with which universal death appears to inspire you, I would put it to you that it is somewhat exaggerated. If you were sent to sea alone in an open boat to some unknown destination, your heart might well sink within you. The isolation, the uncertainty, would oppress you. But if your voyage were made in a goodly ship, which bore within it all your relations and your friends, you would feel that, however uncertain your destination might still remain, you would at least have one common and simultaneous experience which would hold you to the end in the same close communion. A lonely death may be terrible, but a universal one, as painless as this would appear to be, is not, in my judgment, a matter for apprehension. Indeed, I could sympathize with the person who took the view that the horror lay in the idea of surviving when all that is learned, famous, and exalted had passed away."
"What, then, do you propose to do?" asked Summerlee, who had for once nodded his assent to the reasoning of his brother scientist.
"To take our lunch," said Challenger, as the boom of a gong sounded through the house. "We have a cook whose omelets are only excellent by her cutlets. We can but trust that no cosmic disturbance has dulled her excellent abilities. My Schwarzburger of 96 must also be rescued, so far as our earnest and united efforts can do it, from what would be a deplorable waste of a great vintage."
He levered his great bulk off the desk, upon which he had sat while he announced the doom of the planet.
"Come," said he. "If there is little time left, there is the more need that we should spend it in sober and reasonable enjoyment."
And indeed, it proved to be a very merry meal. It is true that we could not forget our awful situation. The full solemnity of the event loomed ever at the back of our minds and tempered our thoughts. But surely it is the soul which has never faced death which shies strongly from it at the end. To each of us men it had, for one great epoch in our lives, been a familiar presence. As to the lady, she leaned upon the strong guidance of her mighty husband, and was well content to go whither his path might lead. The future was our fate, the present was our own. We passed it in goodly comradeship and gentle merriment. Our minds were, as I have said, singularly lucid. Even I struck sparks at times. As to Challenger, he was wonderful. Never have I so realized the elemental greatness of the man, the sweep and power of his understanding. Summerlee drew him on with his chorus of sub-acid criticism, while Lord John and I laughed at the contest, and the lady, her hand upon his sleeve, controlled the bellowings of the philosopher. Life, death, fate, the destiny of man, these were the stupendous subjects of that memorable hour, made vital by the fact that as the meal progressed, strange, sudden exaltations in my mind and tinglings in my limbs proclaimed that the invisible tide of death was slowly and gently rising around us. Once I saw Lord John put his hand suddenly to his eyes, and once Summerlee dropped back for an instant in his chair. Each breath we breathed was charged with strange forces, and yet our minds were happy and at ease. Presently Austin laid the cigarettes upon the table and was about to withdraw.
"Austin," said his master.
"Yes, sir?"
"I thank you for your faithful service."
A smile stole over the servant's gnarled face.
"I've done my duty, sir."
"I'm expecting the end of the world today, Austin."
"Yes, sir. What time, sir?"
"I can't say, Austin. Before evening."
"Very good, sir."
The taciturn Austin saluted and withdrew. Challenger lit a cigarette, and, drawing his chair closer to his wife's, he took her hand in his.
"You know how matters stand, dear," said he. "I have explained it also to our friends here. You're not afraid, are you?"
"It won't be painful, George."
"No more than laughing gas at the dentist's. Every time you have had it, you have practically died."
"But that is a pleasant sensation."
"So may death be. The worn-out bodily machine can't record its impression, but we know the mental pleasure which lies in a dream or a trance. Nature may build a beautiful door and hang it with many a gauzy and shimmering curtain to make an entrance to the new life for our wandering souls. In all my probings of the actual, I have always found wisdom and kindness at the core, and if ever the frightened mortal needs tenderness, it is surely as he makes the passage perilous from life to life. No, Summerlee, I will have none of your materialism, for I, at least, am too great a thing to end in mere physical constituents, a packet of salts and three bucketfuls of water. Here, here," and he beat his great head with his huge hairy fist, "there is something which uses matter, but is not of it, something which might destroy death, but which death can never destroy."
"Talkin' of death," said Lord John, "I'm a Christian of sorts, but it seems to me there was something mighty natural in those ancestors of ours who were buried with their axes and bows and arrows and the like, same as if they were living on just the way as they had used to. I don't know," he added, looking round the table in a shamefaced way, "that I wouldn't feel more homely myself if I was put away with my old 450 Express and the fowling piece, the shorter one with the rubbered stock, and a clip or two of cartridges. Just a fool's fancy, of course, but there it is. How does it strike you, Herr Professor?"
"Well," said Summerlee,
Since you ask my opinion, it strikes me as an indefensible throwback to the Stone Age or before it. I am of the 20th century myself, and would wish to die like a reasonable civilized man. I don't know that I am more afraid of death than the rest of you, for I am an oldish man, and come what may, I can't have very much longer to live. But it is all against my nature to sit waiting without a struggle, like a sheep for the butcher. It is quite certain, Challenger, that there is nothing we can do?
To save us, nothing, said Challenger. To prolong our lives a few hours, and thus to see the evolution of this mighty tragedy before we are actually involved in it, that may prove to be within my powers. I have taken certain steps.
The oxygen?
Exactly, the oxygen.
But what can oxygen effect in the face of a poisoning of the ether? There is not a greater difference in quality between a brickbat and a gas than there is between oxygen and ether. They are different planes of matter. They cannot impinge upon one another. Come, Challenger, you could not defend such a proposition.
My good Summerlee, this etheric poison is most certainly influenced by material agents. We see it in the methods and distribution of the outbreak. We should not a priori have expected it, but it is undoubtedly a fact. Hence I am strongly of opinion that a gas like oxygen, which increases the vitality and the resisting power of the body, would be extremely likely to delay the action of what you have so happily named the daturon. It may be that I am mistaken, but I have every confidence in the correctness of my reasoning.
Well, said Lord John, if we've got to sit sucking at those tubes like so many babies with their bottles, I'm not taking any.
There will be no need for that, Challenger answered. We have made arrangements. It is to my wife that you chiefly owe it, that her boudoir shall be made as airtight as is practicable, with matting and varnished paper.
Good heavens, Challenger, you don't suppose you can keep out ether with varnished paper?
Really, my worthy friend, you are a trifle perverse in missing the point. It is not to keep out the ether that we have gone to such trouble. It is to keep in the oxygen. I trust that if we can ensure an atmosphere hyper-oxygenated to a certain point, we may be able to retain our senses. I had two tubes of the gas, and you have brought me three more. It is not much, but it is something.
How long will they last?
I have not an idea. We will not turn them on until our symptoms become unbearable. Then we shall dole the gas out as it is urgently needed. It may give us some hours, possibly even some days, on which we may look out upon a blasted world. Our own fate is delayed to that extent, and we will have the very singular experience, we five, of being in all probability the absolute rear guard of the human race upon its march into the unknown. Perhaps you will be kind enough now to give me a hand with the cylinders. It seems to me that the atmosphere already grows somewhat more oppressive. End of chapter.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.